The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There was a 22-point increase from 2016 to 2019 among employees in the Legal Bureau who reported that arbitrary acts, personal favoritism, and coercion for partisan political purposes was tolerated, rising from 1% in 2016 to 23% in 2019. The percentage of respondents in the International Organizations Bureau who said that senior leaders did not maintain high standards of honesty and integrity nearly tripled from 12% in 2016 to 35% in 2019. Sadly, given the rhetoric we've seen, these numbers aren't surprising, but they are troubling.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 4th, 2020. Last Friday, the Lawfare Podcast brought you Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's full statement before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and his question and answer session with the senators, all with no bull. A few days before that hearing, the Democratic staff for the committee released its most recent oversight report titled Diplomacy in Crisis, the Trump Administration's Decimation of the State Department. I moderated a panel discussion about that report. Following remarks by Ranking Member Bob Menendez, the expert panel featured three distinguished former ambassadors with close to 75 years of diplomatic experience between them, Tom Shannon, Barbara Stevenson, and Bonnie Jenkins, as well as Elizabeth Shackelford, who in 2017 resigned her career post in protest of the Trump administration. We talked about the contents of the minority staff report, the recommendations it contains, and the long-term consequences of what the report documents for America's foreign policy and national security interests. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 4th, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee's Democratic Staff Report on Diplomacy in Crisis.
Now, many Americans don't get to see firsthand the work of our diplomatic corps, but they are made safer for it every day. The work of diplomats and the Department's civil servants spans from processing visas to promoting U.S. business abroad, to welcoming heads of state, to promoting American values, to preventing conflict, to risking their lives on the front line of crises. And some 250 diplomats have made the ultimate sacrifice for their country. Regardless of who sits in the White House, they take an oath to uphold the Constitution. They carry out their mission without regard to party, to president, or to politics. And in return, and so they can best serve the American people, they should be guaranteed a workplace free from discrimination, politicalization, or retribution. Yet President Trump and members of his administration have belittled our diplomats and the State Department's workforce. While in office, the president has personally falsely smeared them as, quote, radical unelected bureaucrats and the deep state. Political appointees have targeted professional public servants, castigated them as, quote, disloyal for merely doing their jobs. Many have been sidelined, denied promotions, and effectively pushed out of the department. Diplomats have described Trump's political appointees, quote, complete and utter disdain for their expertise. Many have asked themselves if their service is still valued. These unwarranted attacks on professional civil and foreign servants is corrosive for our diplomacy and damaging to our democracy. and it ultimately leaves America less safe. As some of today's panelists can attest, these attacks have contributed to a worrisome exodus of expertise. The State Department cannot afford these losses. Because of a failure to nominate people for key positions, the department has long been struggling with persistent vacancies. For example, the State Department's most senior policy position for Europe has not had a Senate-confirmed official or nominee since February of 2019. The Assistant Secretary for Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance, who works to reduce the threat of weapons of mass destruction, have been vacant for more than a year with no one nominated to fill it. There is currently no Senate-confirmed ambassador or even a nominee for Afghanistan, where Americans are still fighting our longest war, or for Germany, Honduras, or Qatar. For the entire Trump administration, there has been no Senate-confirmed official to lead the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs, charged with managing relations with India and Pakistan and the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan. Indeed, today, 3.5 years into the administration, 11 assistant secretary or undersecretary posts, more than one third, are vacant or filled by acting officials. And only 3 of those positions have nominees pending before the Senate. And it's not just a failure to nominate. This administration has repeatedly nominated candidates who lack the qualifications, the demeanor, the temperament to serve in leadership positions and represent the American people abroad. In my 27 years working on foreign policy in Congress, I have never seen anything like it. President Trump has sent his nominees to represent the American people abroad who have misled Congress, who have made offensive and racist statements, whose resumes would not have even made it through a first round of vetting in any other administration. Now, while some will want to cry foul about congressional obstructionism, the fact is we have confirmed more than 160 nominees, and dozens have advanced quickly without incidents. But when a nominee has made vile comments against sitting senators or their families, or has engaged in racist schemes, or has Me Too problems, or has withheld information and misled this body, they simply do not deserve the honor of representing the United States, and they should not be in senior positions of leadership at the department, period. Yet some of those nominees have gone on to serve in this department, further adding to the decline in morale. Just think about how it feels to be a career public servant, dedicating your life to your country, when your superior is someone who has made comments that are personally offensive to you or your family, or who engaged in conduct that if you had done so, you would have lost your security clearance. The recent dismissal of the State Department's Inspector General at Secretary Pompeo's urging, as he was investigating the secretary himself, only reinforced the sense among career employees that wrongdoing by political appointees get a pass. But those who seek to reveal wrongdoing should watch their backs. And that brings us to today's reality. As this report notes, workplace survey responses of department employees have shown steep increases in fears of reprisal for reporting suspected violations of law and declining confidence in senior department leadership. For example, there was a 22-point increase from 2016 to 2019 among employees in the Legal Bureau who reported that arbitrary acts, personal favoritism, and coercion for partisan political purposes was tolerated, rising from 1% in 2016 to 23% in 2019. The percentage of respondents in the International Organizations Bureau who said that senior leaders did not maintain high standards of honesty and integrity nearly tripled from 12% in 2016 to 35% in 2019. Sadly, given the rhetoric we've seen, these numbers aren't surprising, but they are troubling. Nor do these problems seem to be fixed. Instead, it seems nearly every month there are new reports of conduct by senior political appointees that fall short of what we should be demanding of our senior diplomats. Just this last week, we heard concerning reports that Ambassador Johnson in London may not have only engaged in a troubling act for the president, but has engaged in inappropriate conduct with his staff, and that Ambassador Gunter in Iceland has fostered a difficult work environment for employees, including rotating through multiple deputies. Sobering reality is that President Trump and Secretary Pompeo have left the department decimated and demoralized. This is not a bureaucratic or inside the beltway issue. There are real consequences for the United States and our national security. Our country is weaker when ambassadors aren't present to lead our embassy, build our alliances, and fight for our businesses abroad. With a decimated department, we are forced to play catch up to the rest of the world to advocate for our values, our priorities like human rights, trade, climate change, and other policies. How can we expect to be an example for the world's democracies if we give stamp of approval to nominees who lack the integrity, honesty, and good judgment it takes to represent our country abroad? We can't. We need empowered diplomats with experience and expertise as China seeks to set the rules in international fora and fill the vacuum left behind by President Trump's abdication of leadership. We need leaders who have the authority of Senate confirmation as they engage with foreign counterparts. And we need a diverse, talent-filled diplomatic corps as we seek to secure our interests in the ever-growing list of complex global challenges. Instead, through neglect and corrosive leadership, President Trump and his administration have decimated our nation's premier foreign policy agency dedicated to advancing American values. Today, the department is at a crossroads. This report serves as a clarion call that dramatic action is required to restore the damage and to protect the integrity of U.S. diplomacy. If we expect to have a State Department that can lead us to the global challenges of the next decade, Congress must take full stock of the work that lies ahead. This report, I hope, is the beginning of that conversation. It outlines the steps and pillars for Congress, the Department, and the administration to rebuild the diplomatic corps, to restore accountability, and to reassert our values. They will require sustained effort and focus from current and future leadership. I want to close with this: a sincere thank you to our diplomatic professionals and public servants who work tirelessly day in and day out to deliver results for the American people. I'm convinced I've seen their service as I've traveled the globe. I've seen their service here in Washington. I know what they do for America. The greatest thanks we can give you now is to take action and get the State Department back on track. I intend to deliver on that.
Great. Thank you so much, Senator Menendez. I'm so glad you laid out some of those really concrete facts that are in black and white in the report. And I will want to ask our panelists about some of those facts and figures and their impressions. The format that we're going to do is I'm going to briefly introduce each of our four distinguished panelists. Then each panelist will have about 3 minutes to give some opening remarks. And then we will engage in a question and answer session, which I will begin. And there is an opportunity for members of the audience to submit questions to the chat box. I can't tell you what number of those I may get to, but I will certainly try. We also had some questions that were submitted prior to the event. Okay, so with that, brief introductions for our distinguished panelists. First, Ambassador Tom Shannon spent nearly 35 years in the Foreign Service, served under 6 presidents and 11 secretaries of state, including as career ambassador, and as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, which is the third highest ranking position at the State Department. Welcome, Ambassador Shannon.
Thank you.
Ambassador Barbara Stevenson served for over 30 years in the Foreign Service, serving all around the world. She was the Dean of the Leadership and Management School at the Foreign Service Institute, and she has been the President of the American Foreign Service Association since 2015. Welcome, Ambassador Stevenson. Ambassador Bonnie Jenkins was ambassador from 2009 to 2017, where she served as coordinator for threat reduction programs in the Bureau of International Security and Nonproliferation. She is also the founder and president of the Women of Color Advancing Peace, Security, and Conflict Transformation, which is a nonprofit organization. Thank you and welcome, Ambassador Jenkins.
Thank you for having me.
And last but certainly not least is Elizabeth Shackelford. She was a career diplomat at the State Department until December 2017, when she resigned in protest of the Trump administration. She had served in the U.S. embassies in Warsaw, Poland, South Sudan, Somalia, and also in Washington, D.C. She's the author of a recently published book called The Dissent Channel, a topic we will certainly get to during this panel, and it's an excellent book. So thank you to all of our panelists. I will now turn it over to each panelist for about a 3-minute initial remark. So Ambassador Shannon.
Thank you very much, Margaret. It's a real pleasure to be here with all of you today, especially with our panelists, all distinguished diplomats who served with great success and much accomplishment across their careers. I want to thank Senator Menendez and the minority staff for this important report. I'm especially grateful to Senator Menendez for his tremendous interest in the Department of State and in the Foreign Service and in our civil service, and especially his dedication to diversity, which has been one of the bigger challenges that the department faces and which is mentioned in this report, but which is he has unflaggingly pursued over time and to the well-being of the Department of State and U.S. diplomacy. Yesterday was the 231st anniversary of the Department of State. The Department of State was established on July 27th, 1789, as the first executive branch agency. It's worth noting that our founders did not call the department that deals with foreign affairs the Department of Foreign Affairs. It was called the Department of State for two reasons. First, because the Department of State held the seal of state, which is put on commissions and other formal documents to indicate that it is a document that reflects the views of the United States of America as a state, as an entity, but also because the Department of State was going to represent not just the foreign interests of the United States as a nation, but as a state, as an entity in an international order, and that it was going to speak with a seriousness and a clarity about U.S. interests that would define the United States from its earliest ages as a global actor. And I just want to make a few introductory remarks. First, I want to offer my respect and my admiration to the Foreign Service officers and civil servants who continue to serve so well and faithfully at the State Department. You are all great Americans to whom we owe a large debt of gratitude. Second, the Department, both the Foreign Service and the Civil Service, is going through a profound generational change. This change is happening during a period of political effervescence and polarization within the United States, deep geopolitical change globally, and all under the shadow of the pandemic. The young officers, the women and men who make up the State Department, will be called on by elected officials to analyze and understand this world in transition. They will be called on to present policy recommendations, and they will be called on to implement the policy decisions made by those leaders. Given all that is happening in the world today, I would argue that no generation of State Department officers has faced such challenges or shouldered such responsibilities since the end of World War II and the beginnings of the Cold War. This report is a powerful and important indictment of behaviors that have undermined the State Department, of behaviors that have drained budgets, disrespected and ignored expertise, and sought to marginalize the department in the shaping and implementation of American foreign policy. The loser in all of this is the American people. This generation of State Department officers, the current generation, will be asked to rebuild the world. But I ask, with what? For me, the recommendations in this report are the beginning of a larger conversation about what needs to be done in the executive branch and in the legislative branch to ensure that the Department of State and its officers, Foreign Service and Civil Service, can conduct the analysis, the interagency work, the implementation, and the diplomacy necessary to ensure the peace and prosperity of the United States. Nothing less is at stake, and nothing more is at risk. I would strongly urge that this report be taken seriously, that it be studied in its content, and that its recommendations be understood as a path forward to an America that continues to play an important role in the world and that can protect and defend the interests of the United States of America and the values of the American people. Thank you very much, Margaret.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Shannon. Ambassador Stevenson.
Thank you so much, Margaret. And I join Ambassador Shannon in thanking Senator Menendez and the minority staff who produced this report. For all my Foreign Service friends deployed around the world and my Foreign and Civil Service friends that are keeping the ship of state functioning there at Foggy Bottom, your report tells them that their work on behalf of the American people is valued, and that's a really important message right now. I spent my final years as a Foreign Service officer sounding the alarm about the dismantling of our leadership ranks, especially in the Foreign Service, and about the danger to American global leadership of facing powers such as China, rising powers such as China, without well-staffed and well-led embassies to uphold American values and pursue our interests. This report focuses on issues that have long been important but have become increasingly urgent. The Department of State and the Foreign Service in particular are not in good shape. We, as Americans, need these vital institutions performing at the top of their game as we face rapidly rising global competition for global leadership. During my time as president of the American Foreign Service Association, I would remind everyone who would listen that China's spending on diplomacy had increased by 40% from 2013 to 18, while America's spending on core diplomatic capability had fallen by a third. Since I left office, China has continued to expand its diplomatic reach. And perhaps that's because nothing increases a country's sway and influence quite so cost-effectively as fielding strong teams of top-flight diplomats to embassies across the globe. Like Tom, I want to focus on recommendations, the recommendations for restoring America's diplomatic capability. The need is urgent. And I want to use my time to add two recommendations to the recommendations in the report. First, get the Foreign Service back in the field, back into embassies and consulates where they do the most good for the American people. Despite some attrition, the Foreign Service mid-ranks are more full now than they have been in many years. We have the diplomats. Documented staffing gaps tell us, though, that American embassies don't have enough diplomats on the ground overseas to do core political, economic, and public affairs work. Chinese embassies don't have this problem. It's a bit like China is at bat and the home team has no one covering second base or shortstop. It should come as no surprise if it often looks like China's running the bases. So what can the Senate do to get the Foreign Service back in the field? A modest increase to the ongoing operations line item in the Foreign Affairs budget goes a long way. $100 million is more than enough to add a diplomat to every American embassy and consulate in the world, and you would be so surprised at the impact of that. This committee can also require a report. Secretary Pompeo said on arrival at State, and I quote, "The United States diplomatic corps needs to be in every corner, every stretch of the world, executing missions on behalf of this country. And it is my humble, noble undertaking to help you achieve that." It's a great vision. Let's ask how that's going. Second recommendation, ensure that those embassies are well led. If you put a professional career diplomat at the helm, you can count on decades of experience serving in embassies, learning how to advance America's interests abroad and how to work with the many federal agencies that are present in a typical country team. Mastering the integrated country strategy process that brings all those agencies together in a coherent plan to advance American interests. A well-led American embassy is a sight to behold and a force to be reckoned with. So let me close with this observation. America is an extreme outlier in sending inexperienced people abroad to serve as ambassadors. Just look at Embassy Row here in Washington. The embassies of France, Germany, the Netherlands, India, Russia, all are headed by career professionals with years of experience in their country's diplomatic service. At the British Embassy, Karen Pierce serves as ambassador. We first met in 1992, and I was the junior UK desk officer, and she was a fairly junior officer at the British Embassy. After spending a good decade of my career working on the special relationship, I know what it has done and can do, and I am thrilled to see Karen making the most of that potential. A similar career path was not open to me. As an American diplomat, I had no prospect of serving as the American ambassador to London or Paris, Berlin, Rome, The Hague, Madrid. That reality affects decisions Foreign Service officers make about continuing to serve. We're generally not by temperament well-suited to sitting on the sidelines, and certainly not at a moment like this when America's global leadership is at stake. While not such a path wasn't open to me, you in the Senate can help open a path for the next generation of American diplomats in all their gorgeous diversity. A simple short amendment to the Foreign Service Act of 1980 would do wonders to correct most of the ills this report chronicles. I'm happy to elaborate on those during the panel discussion that follows, but now I'd like to yield to the next panelist, and thank you again for convening us.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Stevenson. Ambassador Jenkins.
Hi, thank you, Margaret. And I also want to thank Senator Menendez and the minority staff for this really, really excellent report. I really enjoyed reading it, and even though there were a lot of things in there that are clearly have to be fixed, it was also a reminder of all the many things that the State Department does, things that are hidden that no one really understands and no one really knows. And so I really do commend this report because I think people should be aware of the wonderful work that's being done that's behind the scenes and really reflects the type of individuals we have representing America, both here and around the world. I thought that the recommendations in the document were extremely well written. And when I looked at them, there are really three categories that I would report that I would put all of them in. But all of them are under the category of champions. And that's what we really need. We need champions. First of all, we need a diversity, equity, and inclusion champion. We need someone at the State Department who is looking at the issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Many of you will read this report, and there are very good things in this report about diversity. And there was also a recent GAO report on this issue. But we need a champion who can deal with some of the issues that are raised in the report, issues of diversity, promotion, and retention. We need a champion who can deal with the cultural changes that need to be made so that the State Department can be more inclusive. We need someone who can help with accountability, so that people feel comfortable saying that they feel as if they've been discriminated against. And we need somebody who can ensure that there's transparency in what's happening and that people can really feel as if they have issues and concerns, that they have someone that they can talk to. The second thing, we need a State Department official, the Secretary of State himself or herself, who is a champion. That person is our first line of defense. That is the person who should be accountable to all the State Department individuals and promotes the interests of State Department individuals, both at state and outside state. This is a person who needs to be able to stand up to the president or anyone else who belittles the State Department and what it does. It is a person who needs to ensure that there's respect for the skills and capabilities of State Department, who is able to do to highlight the jobs that are being done and the points that are made in the report about the work that's behind the scenes. It's someone who can highlight the role of diplomacy and importance of diplomacy and soft power in addition to defense and development. It's someone who would do all the many things that are recommended that would help to deal with morale, who can deal with vacancies and filling leadership, who can ensure that vetting is the best that it can be, who can address corridor reputation and rebuild the expertise. It's a person who can champion the people, the expertise, the dedication, the work that we do at State Department, and ensure that State Department employees are able to fulfill their mission. And lastly, we need a champion who will be a person who will help ensure that the overall environment is one in which State Department can do its work. We need someone who will help ensure that we have a respect for the rule of law, that we are obligated and fulfill our obligations in treaties and conventions, that we respect multilateral institutions, and that we prioritize, as I said, diplomacy as a important means of international engagement. We need someone who will help others understand the importance of everyone being represented when everyone is a face of America. We need someone who will understand that the importance of being a State Department leader means loyalty to the mission, loyalty to the country, and not loyalty to a person. In conclusion, I just want to say that I have always wanted to work in government. I grew up in Bronx, New York, and from the very earliest I can remember, I wanted to work in the federal government. I don't know why I did. I don't know where it came from, but I was not going to stop until I came to Washington, D.C. And I've always been very proud of that decision. I have never once wavered. I never once wanted to do anything else. And I can only say that in my years working in the government, working in Washington, D.C., it's been a wonderful experience, and the people here are amazing. And so they should also be believed in, and they should also be championed. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Jenkins. I also had that same instinct when I left college. I wanted to go work for the federal government. I did. I went to the Justice Department right away. Great. So Elizabeth.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be on this panel with these esteemed ambassadors who have decades of national security service. I bring a different perspective, that of a mid-level foreign service officer who was professionally coming of age at the outset of the Trump administration. Foreign service officers work long hours in hard, often dangerous places, uprooting their lives every few years, often for far less pay than many of us would make in the private sector. Our civil servant counterparts make the same sacrifices, many of them. As a foreign service officer, I worked in two war zones, at times in fear for my own security and for the safety of those who put their trust in me as a U.S. representative. I did this enthusiastically for the same reasons many of my former colleagues did, because I believe that we were capable of achieving a more prosperous and secure global community for the best of America. We did this out of a sense of service and shared purpose. We have lost that sense under the Trump administration. I resigned because I no longer felt that our leadership was on the same team as our mission. And I worried that in my position, I might inadvertently also undermine our national security and my oath of office. I remain grateful for career foreign and civil service officers who remain behind fighting to continue their important work under attack from their own government. We must do more to protect and support them. I strongly agree with this report's recommendations, though I must point out that the State Department's challenges did not begin with this administration. The attacks undermining state have been effective precisely because they have exploited existing institutional weaknesses. The institution's culture, for one, has long been dismissive of dissent. Career officials who push back against prevailing policy are often labeled difficult or problematic. This tendency stifles opportunities for critical self-reflection that would strengthen our foreign policy and has contributed to the problems highlighted in this report. We've seen little dissent out of the department during this period. While several officials testified powerfully during the impeachment, it was in fact only a handful that came forward and in response to subpoenas. How many others might have stepped up if the department had a stronger culture of dissent and internal leadership that was more supportive at the time of doing so? While the State Department's culture has not traditionally tolerated retaliation or political attacks, a culture of quieting those who speak out has laid the groundwork for some of this acceptance. I want to commend the report for highlighting the crisis in diversity, a longstanding problem dramatically exacerbated under this administration. Notably, every mid-level officer I know who has resigned has been a woman, a person of color, or both. All exceptional officers with promising careers ahead. If we want a State Department and a foreign policy that best represents America and her interests, it must look like America and understand America, not just our strengths, but our failures and our weaknesses also. Finally, I want to mention that this report has not addressed one key factor in the State Department's shrinking seat at the national security table: the militarization of our foreign policy. The State Department's influence and role has been diminished by growing numbers of political appointees, by a National Security Council that has in many ways supplanted the department, and by the primacy given to military as a solution of first resort for many years. This did not begin with this administration, but it could end with the opportunity presented right now, or hopefully in the near future, for a real overhaul. A bigger budget and a larger diplomatic corps will not be sufficient. Let's bring State Department back to its rightful place, leading our foreign affairs engagement with expertise and with the authority to use it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to all of you. You each bring a really unique perspective, and yet there are common themes. And so I want to pick up on some of them. But before we do that, I want to start with the report itself and just kind of ask, point out a few of the comments in the report, and also to draw the attention of our listeners to the actual text. And then ask you if you feel like what's highlighted in this report sort of tracks with your experience, because most of you were there quite recently. And so I would just want to get your impression. So it's just a few sort of quotes paraphrased from the report. One is that the hiring freeze, which was put in place under Secretary Tillerson, 96% of embassies and consulates and 95% of bureaus and offices reported that hiring freeze had a negative effect on their operations. That's one data point. The report also says that the department has lost early and mid-career staff at alarming levels, that between July 2017 and June 2018, 722 full-time employees left, which is about 7% of the department's total staff. It also talks about the removal and turnover of deputy chiefs of mission, who are key figures in embassies, particularly in times of transition, who offer lots of seniority and leadership when there isn't an ambassador. According to the resignation of one career Foreign Service officer, the Trump administration's, quote, stinging disrespect, unquote, for the department's diplomatic work drove away experienced and talented staff. Others described a complete and utter disdain for our expertise, unquote, and a, quote, contempt for career employees. According to the report, many diplomats and career employees were asking, quote, if their service is still valued. And then one final thing that's mentioned in the report, it's a quote from Ambassador Tom Pickering, who we all of you know, and probably most of our viewers are aware of, a longtime distinguished ambassador. He said, and this was I think last year, you know, quote, the prevailing mood is low and getting lower if it can, unquote. This report, these quotes paint a quite disturbing and I'd say from my perspective, just quite just dire state of the department. And I want to track our, particularly those who, you have a combined something like 80 years of service in the department, and you've seen so many different administrations. I mean, and are we right here? Is this report right that this is really, really bad compared to prior administrations where there have been problems? Like, is it as bad as it seemed? You all were on the inside. Is it so bad? Ambassador Shannon, would you like to take that one first?
No, thank you again for this opportunity. And let me just start with the hiring freeze. I was the Undersecretary for Political Affairs when Secretary Tillerson and the administration decided to take the decision to impose a hiring freeze on the department. It was complicated and damaging. It was complicated in the short term because we already had one Foreign Service class that was en route to Washington to begin training. And initially the idea was to shut that class down and effectively not give Foreign Service assignments to individuals who had already left previous jobs, sold homes, and bundled their families up to bring them to Washington. We were able to convince the secretary to allow that class to take place, but he was very reluctant to allow any other classes to take place, even though we had already been in communication with individuals about follow-on classes. Also, the initial decision was to shut down all of our Pickering and Rangel fellows who were emerging from universities. The Pickering and Rangel fellowships are kind of like ROTC fellowships. They're scholarships that are given for diversity purposes to very qualified individuals, and in exchange, they agree to spend a certain amount of time working in the Department of State as Foreign Service officers. It's been a hugely successful program for us over time. And, you know, we had responsibilities to these people, and they had made commitments to us. And so we really had to struggle to convince the administration to allow us to move forward with classes that involve Pickering and Wrangell fellows. Ultimately, we were able to do so. But the hiring freeze not only had an impact in Washington, it also had an impact overseas, because in many of our embassies, we hire what are called eligible family members, who over time have increasingly become an important part of our embassy structure, whether it be in consular sections, administrative sections, and other parts of the embassy. And the inability to hire eligible family members really put many embassies that had come to count on them for their operations, their smooth operations, in a really bad situation. You know, we were able to deal with this over time, but the impact was real and significant. And the other issues that you've mentioned were also all present and had to be addressed. But what's worth noting here is that as tough as the situation was, and as challenging as it was for all the reasons you noted, the Foreign Service and the Civil Service is just a really remarkable group of women and men who are committed to what they're doing and understand the importance of it. And there was a certain resilience and tenaciousness about them that I admired and I was very proud of, because they determined that they were just going to get the work done, no matter how hard it was. But we could have done better.
Ambassador Jenkins.
Yes, just very briefly. I cannot remark on the situation when Secretary Tillerson arrived, since I left before that. Just a couple of things. First of all, I do want to thank you, Ambassador Shannon, for the work that you did in keeping the Wrangell and Pickering Fellowship programs going. It's an amazing program, incredibly qualified young men and women who are in that program, and help to increase the diversity of perspectives and cultures. But I will say that on the retention issue, this is something that was certainly raised in a GAO report on the issue of retention of diverse people at the State Department. So that is, and others, but here on the issue of diversity, certainly there has been an issue. We don't have time to go into it, but it was raised briefly in this report. It was also raised in the GAO report. And the only other thing I'll add very briefly is getting to the issue of not being valued. And while I can only speak from what I've been told from those who are in the State Department, I know in the area that I have worked in, which is Weapons of Mass Destruction, there was certainly concerns about the lack of the use of valuable expertise and knowledge in some of the work that has been done on some issues regarding North Korea, engagement on nuclear weapons issues. And so there has been a sense of not being able to play a role that people have spent years in building an expertise in. So I just wanted to raise that point. Thank you.
Ambassador Stevenson.
I want to just reinforce the detrimental impact of that hiring freeze. I know it was imposed government-wide, but it was extended at the State Department. And so particularly our civil servants were frozen into jobs. And so when it was unfrozen, the hiring freeze was removed at other agencies across the government. Some of our most talented civil servants took openings at a higher level elsewhere and left the State Department, creating gaps, including in the human resources infrastructure in the Bureau, making it so difficult for us to ever get back on top of the hiring and the clearance process, et cetera. So we are so far behind now, and there's a need to streamline and improve government hiring. I think it's something that's not in this report, but we grapple with it all the time. But the impact of the hiring freeze, yes, there was a spectacular removal of all of our five out of six of our four-star career ambassador rank people. And I don't know, two-thirds of our three stars as well. So that got national media attention, but throughout the ranks, it was just left weakened and very hard then to right the ship as the result of that hiring freeze. Catastrophic error, and I hope it's something that Congress will speak up about and really try to avoid. It was the Congress's decision to insist on restoring State Department budgets to their previous level and to reject the 30% cut that finally tied Secretary Tillerson's hands and caused him to have to pull back on this hiring freeze and this removal of all these people. So the heroes of this story are Congress.
Elizabeth.
The State Department has long had personnel challenges to face, but the difference under this administration, I felt while I was still in it, was that it seemed intended to undermine the effectiveness of the institution, or at least of the activities of the career personnel involved. And the loser in all of that has been the American people. And if people hadn't realized that before, because so much of what we do is behind the scenes, I think it's become pretty obvious under the COVID pandemic that we're really losing out because we've handicapped our career officials so much.
So just picking up on that, one of the things that the report focuses on in the beginning is really explaining in plain terms why it is that the work of the State Department is so valuable for Americans. And I think it does a really good job of that. And I would like if you're inclined to give an anecdote, if you have one, about how what you did or someone you worked with really had an impact for America's national security or for Americans themselves. I mean, you all have been up to the eighth floor of the State Department, which are beautiful diplomatic rooms, almost entirely funded through donations from Americans, many of whom had themselves or their children or someone in their families who was stuck in a country or who was really helped by an embassy abroad, and just helped tremendously, so much that people are moved to give grants of money to the State Department. They're so thankful for the work that consular officers and embassy officers did for their own families. So I just would invite all of you, because we have such a good opportunity to showcase some of the wonderful work of the department. If there is something you want to show as that's emblematic of that type of work, which I think gets lost to most everyday Americans who sort of think about the State Department in an abstract way. Ambassador Stevenson.
So my tagline as AFSA president was that to members of Congress, no matter where your constituents, no matter why they find themselves overseas. So whether that's to study abroad or to climb a mountain or to expand a business or to adopt a baby, they have a home base called the American Embassy, where fellow Americans like me are there, and I speak the local language, I know how to get things done, and I have their back, and I'm there to help them succeed. So I still think that's one of the most true things. And now that we are in a phase, as Lizzie said, where the embassies aren't operating at full strength, I'm in higher education now, operating study abroad programs and bringing students and scholars in. Without those embassies functioning, it affects us every single day, most of my day, trying to figure out how do we do this without the embassies. Two stories. I'm from rural Florida. Cattle, we had more cows than people. And the screwworm is an issue in Florida. It plants eggs in the hide of cattle, and it costs you like 25% of your cattle industry. Over the years, the U.S. Department of Agriculture got rid of this program. I got rid of this plague, and they moved it through Florida and then through Alabama and then through Texas, and then started to realize they could bring the screwworm down the Central America, the isthmus, through Mexico and through Guatemala. And when I was a first tour junior officer in Panama, part of what I worked on as the agricultural person was a program to irradiate the male flies so that the flies that are out flying around are sterile and they don't lay the eggs. So it's where the break is now. The screwworm that used to be such a plague to the cattle industry in my home state of Florida and all across through Texas, it moved down and it moved down, and the break was established in Panama. And when I went back as ambassador about 20 years later, that program was thriving. And one of my very favorite trips I ever got to do was going way into the Darien jungle, that impassable strip between Colombia, that big old part of South America where the screwworm still exists and plagues all the cattle, into to that narrow strip in Panama where we maintain the break, and meet with this really extensive network of members of our commission that work together in partnership with the United States to inspect by hand every single shipment of cattle that moved through by truck to make sure that they didn't reinfect it. It's this classic example of a win-win. The Panamanians benefited from getting rid of the screwworm in their state, but in their partnership with us, they also kept our cattle industry safe. I love that story because I think it's such a practical way of describing how we keep threats at bay by working in partnership. Thanks for letting me tell that story.
I love that.
If I could, Margaret, you know, Americans travel and they get in a lot of trouble when they travel, good reasons and bad. And obviously consular affairs are dealing with people who have been injured, are in hospitals, have been arrested or have been killed or died is a big part of what we do. And the welfare and well-being of Americans is a huge priority and responsibility for American embassies. But I want to tell a commercial anecdote, which comes from my time at our embassy in Brasilia when I was ambassador from 2010 to 2013. And we were battling to determine who was going to be Brazil's primary economic partner, whether it was going to be the United States and China. And this was at a moment of great economic kind of growth and interest in Brazil as its middle class grew and it traveled and it became interested in replicating the kind of lifestyle it had seen elsewhere in the world. And so American companies began lining up to see what Brazil was and whether or not there were economic opportunities there. And that required our embassy to realign itself and to build a connectivity between those parts of the embassy that work on economic and commercial issues, but also to ensure that there was easy access to me, to the ambassador. And so I worked very closely with our foreign commercial service, especially with a senior commercial officer named Brian Brissom and his extraordinary team. And we made sure that any American businessman or woman, any investor who wanted to meet with me could see me and that I would engage with them and work with them to do everything we possibly could to ensure that their experience in Brazil was a positive one and a successful one. And it was hugely important, whether it be in automobiles, whether it be in civil aviation, whether it be in medical devices, whether it be in agriculture, all of the areas where Brazil's economy was growing and expanding, but also in the retail trade area. And our ability to bring in CVS and Walgreens and Walmart and any number of other American retailers was a big deal and an important part of what we were doing. But I would also say that, you know, and I don't mean to tell her what to talk about, but we have an extraordinary political officer on this panel. Liz Shackelford was famous in the department for her political reporting, especially out of South Sudan, Juba, and Somalia. And I remember in the times that when I was leading the U.S. delegation to South Sudan peace talks that were being held mostly in Addis Ababa, I relied on her reporting. And I asked for it whenever I could get it. So, Liz, again, I'm sorry to call you out like this, but political reporting is a huge part of what we do, and it shapes how the American government behaves.
Elizabeth, would you care to respond?
Sure. Ambassador Shannon, I am humbled by that and that you even still remember that. But of course, my time in South Sudan was a remarkable period in which I was able to both, as a junior officer, I was the second tour officer at the time, and I was writing reporting that I never believed would be read at the highest levels of the department and that would actually influence the policy that we were doing. And that was one of my proudest moments, matched only by the work that I was doing at the same time in what was a dramatically understaffed embassy at the outset of a war, with running evacuations, being our lead consular, our only consular officer in South Sudan, working on getting, I believe, ultimately it was about 1,100 people out, about half of whom were Americans. So I've been thinking a lot about that period over the past several months, as I've heard from a lot of friends working in different parts of the world, still trying to evacuate Americans out, and thinking about all of the ones who have been dual-headed, trying to keep their finger on the pulse of the place where they are, while also directly helping, you know, Americans in many numbers. And it's been a great honor to have the opportunity to both influence and work through our political systems, and to have a situation where we had such respect for, you know, career personnel who were doing that work back at the, you know, back in Washington. So again, thank you so much, Ambassador Shannon.
So we actually don't have a whole lot of time, just a few more minutes. And so I want to end with a question that actually came in before the panel. So it is an audience audience-generated question, and it has to do specifically with how Secretary Tillerson and Secretary Pompeo have affected the morale and what the impact is on foreign policy and our national security if career public servants are, if there is low morale, if there is this demoralization. If people could speak to that, you know, what are the, not only the short term, but the longer term impacts of this low morale in the State Department? I do think that it's just abstract, I think, for a lot of people when they think about, well, what really is the outcome for the United States? And a couple of you have touched on it and said the real loser in this are the American people. Bring that home for us. Tell us how that, you know, those dots really, really get connected. Elizabeth, please.
Just to briefly dovetail off what I was just speaking on, I and many of my colleagues during periods of crisis, both in South Sudan, in Somalia, when I was working in the State Department Operations Center, those were incredibly challenging times. We were working on very little sleep in fear of our own security. And it was knowing that the work that we were doing was valued and respected back at the department, that people were listening and that what we did mattered. And that was what continued to drive us during those critical times. So I cannot overstate the importance that knowing what you're doing is mattering and matters and is being respected. What effect that has on your ability to do your job in these very, very challenging situations. So yes, right now, I feel like the people who are at the State Department do not feel that respect or that support. And I think that is incredibly detrimental to their morale and their ability to effectively do their jobs.
Quickly add to that, great point about the hard work, the long hours, and also what we're seeing now is people are leaving. And then you get lots of gaps in expertise. We have to basically rebuild in many ways the State Department because so many people have left. We've lost expertise. And so now that we're facing all these incredible challenges right now, we have to figure out how we're going to deal with that without the longstanding background that we had before. So for me, it's people leaving and what that means in terms for the great work that everybody's been talking about.
I mean, one of the recommendations of the report is to take steps to clear a path for more mid-level career folks to come in. I know that's been a topic of discussion at the department for years. You know, Ambassador Stevenson, Ambassador Shannon, as you make your last remarks, I would just be curious to know what you thought of that particular recommendation as a way of filling gaps that do come about in the sort of mid-level category, as well as this broader question of the real impacts for the American people on the low morale. Yeah. Ambassador Stevenson, please.
I'd want to look at the staffing charts to see if there's been any change, but I tracked this very carefully and would meet regularly with Senate staff on the topic while I was AFSA president until a year ago. Our mid-ranks are at their fullest level in many years, and so the need to bring people in is actually, I don't know what it is. What happened is Secretary Colin Powell hired when he was secretary, and those people now have worked their way up, and there are ranks of our colonels and lieutenant colonels, our FS1s and twos, and then Secretary Clinton had a very large hiring surge while she was secretary as well, and they filled the ranks of the threes and the fours. So swooping people in is kind of, I don't know what problem you're trying to solve with that, and it actually adds to what they're pretty full in the mid ranks, but they're clustered. The career path is not right, which is why I really argue for creating 300 to 500 new positions in the field, because they've been brought back to Washington as we did the Iraq tax. There's a long, complicated history of this. But really, we have loads of people. We need to get the positions recreated so that we can have robust embassies and the ability to mentor the next generation. The first thing you lose when you understaff those substantive sections and embassies is the ability to mentor the next generation, which I think is having a detrimental impact on a range of things, including retaining diversity. It takes time to cultivate these officers. So I actually don't see what the need for that is. The numbers show that they're full, and the main thing is to create the billets for them so that they can get out and actually work for the American people and be part of a mentoring team to raise the next generation.
Ambassador Shannon, you're going to have the last word.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I understood the recommendation a little differently. I really understood it as helping to restore expertise to the department and trying to address the fact that the department lost a lot of officials who probably had another good 10 to 15 years left in them before they departed. And in a department that, as I noted earlier, is going through enormous generational change and actually has a fairly kind of a young component, mentoring is hugely important. Ambassador Stevenson mentioned this. And making sure that we have enough experienced officers, senior officers, who can provide the mentoring that's needed right now is very important. But also filling these expertise gaps that have been created over time, I think, is important. And so finding a mechanism that allows that to happen would be good. And let me just close with on the question of morale. You know, Foreign Service officers can be a grumpy lot. And, you know, we used to like to joke that, you know, morale at the department is always as bad as it's ever been. But morale in the department and in the Foreign Service and the civil service is really not about moods. It's not about whether you feel good or bad. It is, as Liz noted, whether you feel respected, because a lot is asked of people. And if you're sitting at the American consulate in Peshawar, and you know that just by stepping outside, you're risking your life, but you do it every day, several times a day, because you know that you have to meet with people, that you have to understand what's happening in that part of Pakistan, that you need to understand and recognize the impact of what's happening there on what's happening in Afghanistan and elsewhere. You do it, and you do it not only out of service to country and duty, but because you believe that it's understood, respected, and needed. And when that's lost, you lose a lot, because then you're asking people to go out and take risks for what end and for what purpose. So I would just end by saying that, you know, when I came into the Foreign Service in 1984, the trajectory of American power was set, and we were fighting the Soviets. It was the Cold War, and we knew what we had to do. And in many ways, the watchwords for my generation were service and duty. I would argue that for the new generation of American officers, in the midst of the kind of transformation the world is seeing today, duty and service is still important. But what matters is creativity and innovation in order to be able to understand the changes that are taking place and to adapt to them, but also resilience. The idea that we're in a fight. We're in a fight globally, but we're also in a fight domestically. And that sometimes we're going to get roughed up in that fight. But having the support of the department, of the White House, of the Congress, is hugely important to American diplomats. And so I commend the senator for this report. I commend the minority staff that worked so hard on this. And I just say how honored I am to be here with the other panelists.
Well, I want to say thank you to all of you. This has been just enormously informative. You have just tons of experience. It's such a pleasure to hear from all of you. And you're all very inspirational in your own ways. So thank you.
Margaret?
Please.
Hi. I'm glad I got back from votes for a little while. I've been listening to some of the conversation. And it is this type of expertise we relish and enjoy and are the beneficiaries of, and that we'd want to see at the State Department. And so, you know, I appreciate the insights. I'd love to ask Elizabeth what was in her political reporting that actually brought the Assistant Secretary's attention, but maybe that will be for another time so that we can all learn from what makes for good political reporting at the end of the day as an insight. But these are some of the critical questions, and I look forward on Thursday morning when the Secretary is before us to having an opportunity to discuss some of this. But I really think of the report as a real foundation. I mean, you know, just in reality, we have only a few months left of this legislative year, but a real foundation to build upon for what remains of this Congress, particularly as we deal with budgetary elements. I mean, a 30-some-odd percent cut to the State Department's budget is unacceptable, even though they continue to offer that. And we have led the charge to restore the State Department's money. But money alone doesn't buy the respect that career people need to have to understand that their work is merited and worthy and listened to, even if they don't always agree. but the insights are incredibly important. So thanks again to everybody who watched, and thanks to our extraordinary panelists. I'm glad I got back to hear some of the insights. Thanks, everybody.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to share the podcast on social media and give us a rating and review wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.